You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
When the world and I were young, just yesterday, such a simple game the child could play.
It was easy then to tell right from wrong, easy then to tell weak from strong, when a man should stand and fight or just go along. But today there is no day or
or tasted fear.
It was easy then to tell truth from lies, selling out from compromise, who to love and who to hate, the foolish from the wise. But today there is no day or night, today
Shades of Grey by the Monkees, and I'm Sam Stone. Welcome to the 45th edition of the Stone Tapes. And following the death of Peter Tork this week, I thought we'd do a sort of sequence of playing the Monkees music as a bit of a tribute to them, because I don't know if you guys feel like this, but I used to think the Monkees were brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the first manufactured bands ever, which our special guest is going to tell us a bit more about shortly, I'm sure. But first of all, let's see who's here. We've got in the studio George Mann.
Hello.
Patricia H. Ash on the phone. Hello, Patricia.
Hi.
In the studio, our special guest, Aisha Brough.
Hi.
And, of course, our producer, Alex Lefchuk.
Hello.
He's talking today.
So, I've got a microphone.
He's actually got a microphone. We let him have a microphone today. I might regret that as time goes on, but we'll see how it goes. Aisha, you were talking to me before the show about some memories of the Monkees. So before we move on to Patricia's review, can you remind me what you were saying about this particular band and how they formed?
Well, many years ago, I was asked by my agent if I would go and meet with Donnie Kirshner, who was this mega music mogul, and because he was about to form a band along with Harry Saltzman, who was Cubby Broccoli, of Bomb Film fame, and they wanted to do something. The first actual real manufactured band was the Archies, and they wanted to do something to follow up for that. I hadn't even really seen much of the Archies. Anyway, I went to meet with Donnie, and he liked me because he's more music-based, and he introduced me to Harry Saltzman, who said, well, I don't really like her. She looks a bit like Cher to me, which was a bit, which was a bit disheartening. But I knew that Donnie liked me, and he said, I'm going to try to get you to be the girl singer in this. I think there's going to be about four of us or five of us in the band. And later on that day, some of the other people who'd been cast in the band, I met up with them, and they said, oh, we're all going to a nightclub, which was the place in London then called the Aretusa. And one of them was Davy Jones. And oh, wow. He was so sweet to me, and he said, this is going to be fantastic, Aisha. They're going to spend so much money, and we're going to be so famous, and it's wonderful. And we went, and we had this great evening. Obviously, Harry Saltzman won out, and I wasn't picked. And then many years later, when I had my television show, I became very good friends with Olivia Newton-John. We were talking one evening. We'd been friends for a long time, and I said, how did you start? And I was telling her, and she said, oh, well, I got picked to be in this group called Tomorrow. And that was the band. And so she went, but they never actually went out and performed. There was Davy Jones and a couple of others and Olivia, and they spent all the money and did a recording, but they never actually did anything.
And then Davy, of course, went on to be in the Monkees.
It was fine for him. It was fine for him.
So it was probably a good stepping stone for him initially then.
Yeah, because I think he'd played Artful Dodger in Oliver.
I can see that.
But he was a sweet, he was very much of the ilk. There were a lot of us in the pop industry then that had actually come through the theatrical training schools. And so we'd done musical comedy and then went into pop. Whereas the majority of pop people were just straight out of regular life. But Davy had had a similar background to me, and so that's why we got on and that. But he was a very, very nice man indeed.
I can imagine. And we're going to come back to you very shortly, Aisha. But first of all, we're going to go to to Patricia and ask for her review. What are you reviewing this month, Patricia?
This month, I am reviewing an audio drama podcast. It'll be right up your alley. It is horror and so very good at the suspense and oh my goodness, sort of a Lovecraftian feel.
Sounds good.
It's called The White Vault, and it's so very good. So you can find it anywhere you've got podcasts. I found it on iTunes. So the plot is, This group of scientists need to go to a remote outpost on Svalbard to fix a thing that's broken. Like, I think it's some kind of radio transmitter doohickey that's recording geological data or some science thing.
The science MacGuffin.
Anyway, yes, the science MacGuffin. So this group of scientists goes to the science MacGuffin, and there's a horrible blizzard, and they're stuck in a little bitty little bunker. So they fix the thing, but then stuff starts happening, and I really don't want to say much more about it because I really don't want to spoil it. It is so good, and it just doesn't. The twists don't turn in the direction you expect them to.
So there's no predictability. I like the sound of that already.
There's a little bit of predictability. You're like, oh, that person has a family and is about to get married. Gee, I bet they don't live through this. Oh, look at that. they don't live through it.
So what attracted you to this in the first instance? How did you hear about it?
I was listening to a couple of other podcasts, and a promotion for this, like a little ad, came on, and it sounded so creepy and just so well produced. And I was familiar with a couple of the other voice actors because they were in a couple of other shows that I was interested in. So I was like, oh, well, I'd like to hear more of that guy, so let's just listen to this White Vault thing. And so then 2 days later, I'd listen to all of it.
Wow. So what's the format? Are they full cast dramas and like half-hour episodes or something along those lines?
Yeah, something like that. I think they're 40 minutes-ish.
That's long.
In length.
Mm.
Yeah. So they only did... There was a long time between the seasons, and there's a long time between episodes because it is so well produced. There's all kinds of sound effects and music, and everything is just gorgeous.
Is it a free to listen to one, or do you have to buy it?
Oh yeah, yeah, free to listen to.
Wow.
There is, you know, additional content on their Patreon because that's how podcasts do. But it is fantastic.
Wow, sounds amazing.
That's a good recommendation, huh?
Yeah. We'll be back shortly with George, Comics with George, our new feature, the second time. but, of course, we're going to listen to a bit more Monkees now, Daydream Believer.
7A.
What number is this, Chip?
7A.
Okay, no, I mean, like, don't get excited, man. It's because I'm short, I know.
I could hide 'neath the wings of the bluebird as she sings. The 6 o'clock alarm would never ring, but it rings and I rise, wipe the sleep out of my eyes. My shaven razor's cold and it stings. Cheer up, sleepy Jean. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream believer and a homecoming queen? You once thought of me as a white knight on his steed. Now you know how happy I can be. Starts and ends without a dollar one to spend. But how much, baby, do we really need? Cheer up, sleepy Jean. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream?
Now we're here with George's Comics. George, what have you been reading this
Hello.
Week?
Well, I thought, I've had Star Wars on my mind recently.
Interesting.
Because I'm it's been announced now, so I'm allowed to talk about it. I've written a Star Wars book.
Yay!
Hey! Which is coming out in August.
Fantastic. But one Congratulations.
Of the, thank you. And it's been hugely exciting to do, but one of the most enjoyable things about it has been it's been immersing myself in Star Wars and the Star Wars universe in preparation for it. And because of the type of book it is, it's kind of it's a book of myths and legends and fables. It had to be more than what you see in just the film, so I've been diving a bit deeper into the Star Wars lore. And as part of doing that, I've been reading all the comics. So I thought in this comics slot, I'd basically give people a little bit of a primer on what's going on with Star Wars comics at the moment, because Star Wars comics have a very long history. They, you know, originally, when I was a kid, I used to get the reprint, the UK reprints of the Marvel Star Wars comics, which were absolutely wonderful. And mad and absolutely bonkers as well. They went off in all sorts of weird tangents. There's a rabbit bounty hunter called Jackson and all sorts
wow,
of mad stuff.
Wow, very unusual.
Yeah. And then later, Dark Horse Comics started publishing. They got the license after Marvel had finished with the license and started publishing loads of stuff. And they did a great job as well. And that was a time when there was no films and they were using the comics as kind of the main vehicle, comics and books, main vehicle to develop the IP. Then when Disney bought Marvel, obviously they already had Lucasfilm in a recent acquisition as well. So they, as soon as the license came up for renewal with Dark Horse, they pulled it all back.
Yes.
And that's the same point where they went, well, clean slate. All of those stories are great, but we're going to brand them Star Wars Legends.
Wow.
Which means they're not part of the continuity. And the only thing that's in continuity at that point, this was 2015, is the films and the animated series. And at that point, they relaunched all the comics through Marvel again. So it was kind of a bit like Star Wars comics were coming home.
Yeah, so you've got a kind of rebirth as well of it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So while there's these sways of great and years worth of great Star Wars comics, and there's a lot to love in those older comics, there was a brilliant jumping on point in 2015 as well. And that's where I've been immersing myself, to read those with a view to kind of picking up some kind of more of the depth of the world. And there's a couple of main series, really, that I think are worth mentioning. There is a main Star Wars comic series by Jason Aaron and various artists that started in 2015, and it's about 60 issues in now.
Wow.
So there's quite a bit of to go back to. But it's really, really well-written stuff. It's and really well-drawn stuff as well. And there are adventures that are set between the first and the second film. So they really do a lot to fill out the characters and show that progression that you see between the two movies.
So first and second film, are we talking in the Lucas timeline? The original film. Right.
So Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back.
Fantastic, because somebody like me, who is a more original Star Wars fan rather than later films,
me
although
too.
I've heard Rogue One is amazing, I need to
it's
see
great,
it.
It's great, yeah.
I would love that, because it's character development within that that I really
yeah,
wanted
so it goes
to see.
Back to
that
the,
sounds amazing.
Luke, Leia, Han. And actually, that's what it does. It takes those three characters and really sends them off on these great stories. So Leia in particular actually becomes the kind of the strong female character that you see later in these comics. So she goes off on missions for the rebellion. Han, there's a whole story about this woman who turns up and claims to be his wife. And no one knows what's going on. Leia's a bit kind of grumpy about it all.
I'm sure.
No one knows what's going on. And Luke is looking for more stories, more evidence of what happened to his father, because he still doesn't know at that point what's going on. So you've got all these threads, plus, of course, the usual Star Wars space battles and, you know, monsters and all of that stuff.
How are they drawn? Do they look anything like...
They do, yeah. I mean, that's one of the other great things about them, actually. They, because there's been so many wonderful artists work on Star Wars comics over the years, you've had lots of different interpretations of the characters. One of the things that I think Marvel clearly set out to do with this reboot was to draw the actors in the roles.
Brilliant.
So it's actually, it is, you know, and that's particularly true if there's another series, which I'm going to talk about next, which is a Darth Vader series. And that's particularly true. There's all the art in that series is done by a guy called Salvador LaRocca. And they're almost photorealistic.
Oh,
I love it. It's amazing. It's really, really well done. And that series is written by Kieran Gillen, and it's set during the same period. And it lasted 25 issues, and then there's a new author come on to do some new Darth Vader stories. But this is a brilliant run as well, because it's a real character study of the making of a villain. And it touches between, because obviously Vader's a part of the Star Wars comics, and you see his plots. And he's not as taken with the Emperor as you think. He's kind of still working out the Emperor at this point. And there's a wonderful scene, because it kind of reveals more depth than what you're getting in the films. Because obviously between the first film and the second film, he finds out that Luke's his son.
Oh right, yes, of course.
Because we find out with Luke, but Vader obviously knows.
But he knew before.
But he didn't know. Wow. So you see that happen. You see the point where he finds out that the rebel pilot who blew up the Death Star is called Luke Skywalker, and he hears the name, and he's looking out the window of a Star Destroyer, and the window just cracks, But it's because, you know, the
rage,
the force
inside
the,
of all.
And the rage,
or
the
force of emotions, even perhaps.
Yeah, yeah, exactly,
you know,
that.
Vader's emotions. Yeah, fascinating.
So it's kind of again, another great character study. And one of the great things it also does is it introduces a character called Dr. Aphra. And she's one of the only new characters who's been introduced to the Star Wars canon through comics, who's then gone on to have action figures and things. And she's like a space archaeologist, essentially. She's a villain, but she's kind of a bit...
Nice part.
But yeah, a bit grey. You know, sometimes she might... She'll do what's right for her, not necessarily what's right for... Her
morals are kind of floating. Yeah, and sometimes she's bad, sometimes she's good.
Exactly.
Like that.
And
like
she finds herself working for Vader and trying desperately to keep him happy, because she knows he'll kill her if he's not happy, but also to get her own way. And she's got two droids who work with her, and they're like C-3PO and R2-D2. There's a protocol droid like C-3PO called 000, who's murderous and likes to torture people.
Oh,
and
oh,
takes great
gosh.
Delight. He's got little injections and needles that come out of his fingers. And and the other droid, BT-1, is like R2-D2, but he's got all these guns and weapons.
Oh, awesome.
And they go around with her. And 000 is always... There's a bit of code that stops him killing her, but he wants to kill her
and
do horrible things. And it's great stuff. And she ended up getting her own series of comics because she was so popular.
Oh, that's amazing.
So they've made action figures and all sorts about her now.
Any thoughts, Patricia? Anything you'd like to ask George about this series?
How can I read it? Because it sounds amazing.
There's a great Marvel app. I'm not advertising on behalf of Marvel, I will say here, but they do have a Netflix for comics called Universe, Marvel U, and you can pay a subscription fee, and it's got basically their entire back catalogue up to 6 months ago.
Wow!
And every week they put comics onto the comics onto
That's
it.
That's brilliant.
So you can pay a subscription, go on, and you can read
you
all
read
of these
it.
Comics,
oh,
and
wow.
all of the original Star Wars comics are on there as well. So if you like,
it's amazing.
And Spider-Man, and you know all the Marvel heroes. It's a great app, actually.
If you've never read any of the back catalogue, would you be able to start with this new reboot and be
here.
Really in it?
Absolutely. If you know the films, all you need to know is the films, and you can start with these comics.
Sounds
and
fantastic.
They start filling in that. And then you might find yourself going off and looking for other things because, you know, it's
so
it holds your hand and takes you through the story. And then there's novels and there's other comic series that kind of fill in other gaps between other films. Or Poe Dameron from the new films has got a comic series. And there's a little Chewbacca miniseries. And it starts to spread out. But the way to start is the Star Wars comic and the Darth Vader comic, I think.
Right, before we leave this, George, I think you need to give us a bit more information about the book you've written. Tell us a little bit about that.
Thank you. Well, I can't say too much. I can only say what they said in the press release.
Yes.
But it's called Star Wars Myths and Fables, and it's out August the 6th from Disney Lucasfilm Press. And it's essentially a book of myths and fables from the Star Wars universe. So a bit like if you think of like Grimm's Fairy Tales, but the Star Wars version.
And I definitely want one.
they gave a sample away when they announced it on the StarWars.com website. There's a press release, and there's a sample from the first story called The Knight and the Dragon.
Great.
And it's set on Tatooine with a knight fighting protecting a village from a dragon. And
seriously, I'm fangirling here. I'm really... You mentioned Tatooine, and I was like, oh!
It was one of those things. You know, like, the first time you type TARDIS or something, it's like typing lightsaber or Tatooine, you go, oh, my God! Oh. I had to get it from the computer and walk away and then come back.
I'm not surprised. Because, of course, you're a huge fan of the franchise, aren't you?
Yeah, so absolutely.
Perfect person to write it, to be honest.
Yeah, as I say, as a little kid, I used to get the comics and obviously watch the films. And one of the first films my granddad ever took me to see was Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, it's just such an amazing film as well.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, George. That's just fantastic.
No problem.
And we'll have another little... we haven't got a musical interlude here, but where am I? I'm imagining it. We're now going to go back to Aisha, and we'd like to ask you some questions. And feel free to chip in, Patricia, if you've got anything you'd like to ask Aisha. But I'll just give you a little bit of an introduction, because I haven't really done that yet. Aisha, of course, you're very well known for two very big things. One is Liftoff, and the other, of course, is UFO, both of which are very, very interesting to the Stone Tapes, because we love all of this. We love all things musical, and we love all things genre. So can you tell us a little bit about where your musical career started?
Well, I went to a theatrical training school called Arts Educational, And I think that I was very much a product of the time that when you're a 14-year-old girl, the music that you love, and if you're studying music and drama, instead of wanting to go into musical comedy, which is what everybody was doing from my school, I wanted to be the Beatles. The whole thing, my career started because I fell in love with Paul McCartney when I was about 11. And I thought, I worked out that if I became a pop singer, I would have to meet him. It would have to happen. And that was why I chose that direction. And, you know, I was saying to you earlier today, the world was so different for pop. I mean, you could literally say to yourself, well, I think I'd really like a recording contract. So I went into my bathroom with a tatty old little cassette player and sang in the bathroom because you got a bit of echo and that helped the song. And recorded something, and then marched into a studio, a label, and said, can I meet somebody? Didn't even know they were called A&R men, because I'd like a record deal. And they took the tape off me, and they played it, and then they sent me a letter, and they signed me.
Wow. I mean,
so you just don't hear stories like that. Yeah, it's amazing.
And that's the way the industry was. It wasn't as corporate. It was everybody knew everybody. And you would know someone who would know someone else who would. So I sent this tape in. I got signed eventually by a man called Harry Robinson, who was actually, if I can remember this, he was on Oh Boy. He had the orchestra, Harry Robinson's orchestra. And he opened a record label called Brit Records with Chris Pierce and Chris Blackwell. And so they signed me. There was myself, there was the Spencer Davis group, and there was a guy called Bobby Jameson. It was a very small label. They signed me to that label. I had one record out, and then I got signed by Fontana. And then for the next 10 years, when my contracts were up, I was signed to another label or another, that label, I stayed with them. I got lift off because I was guesting on a pop program for Granada, and the cameras broke down during the day, and I was, you know, very happy to be doing what I did, so I was laughing and joking, didn't mind that it was taking like hours, and they literally called me the next day and said, would you like the show?
Wow.
Would you become the hostess? And I said, oh yes, that would be nice. And I was there 10 years later. So that's how I started that, and I'd gone to Germany when I was about 17. I'd lied, said I was 18, and did all the American bases with the Drifters.
Wow!
I don't know how I got. Don't ask me how I got it. I don't know how, but I had never ever performed as myself. I'd been trained as a dancer and an actress and a singer, but to be somebody else, not to be myself. And I found myself on this train going to Germany. And I met up with the Drifters, who I loved. I mean, I bought their records up on the roof, and I thought it was all so fabulous. And I came out the first night and did my little 15-minute act. But I'd only been out of school a year, and one of the Drifters called me aside, and he said, you got a great voice, honey, but you got to get rid of that accent. And I said, what accent? He said, you sang tonight, see the girl with the red dress on. She can do the dog all night long. Well, all right. He said, I have never heard anything so horrible in my life. And I said, well, what do I do? He said, you've got to get a mid-Atlantic accent. He said, because it's not to be fake, but the words just lend themselves. You know, you've got to do dance and not do dance. He said, So after about 2 months with the Drifters, I was a different artist. They really knocked me into shape. They were fabulous. Great guys.
What a great experience.
I know. They were incredible. Their voices, oh, Sam, they came out and sang live. It was like listening to the records.
Just like Velvet, aren't they?
And they had these orange suits, and they were doing, you know, like the Temptation dances and that. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm never going to be that good. They're so great. They were lovely. They took me under their wing, and they would sing gospel songs as we traveled around. And they would say, this is your part. And I'd go, I don't know it. And they'd say, improvise. Great.
Any questions from anybody? Alex, any questions? Put you on the spot like you do to me.
Exactly. Completely lost the... I mean, I'm sure it's fantastic, that whole wealth of information that you've actually got there. And you said it's changed. Has it changed from the point of view of people can still actually go to their bedroom and record on their iPhones and people still actually
do
that?
I think in the last few years, it's starting now to be almost the same thing as that, but obviously modernised. It had reached a point where it was virtually impossible to get a deal. And then you had the advent of, you know, X Factor and all of the talent shows. But it started probably about 10 years ago. Was it, I've forgotten his first name, Bedingfield.
Daniel Bedingfield.
Who made that tape and it ended up being number one. And it was but it just didn't take off. And I think now that's what the new generation of musicians will do. They know that they can't get the distribution and they don't have the money to, you know, to do the things themselves. They'll start making their own production, but not in studios.
No.
They'll be doing it at home. And I think that's the way that it's going to go.
We've kind of got that on YouTube as well, haven't we? YouTubers that sing. And we used to have it on MySpace.
Yeah. Yes. What's her name? Lily Allen started that way and so on. So it's always been, but it hasn't been the mainstream. But I can't imagine, Sam, what it is like now to come out. Now, first of all, you have to remember, I had a lot of things against me for today, but not for then. In those days, if you had a good voice, if you were pleasant to look at, and if you could perform, you could make it. They're coming out now that you can have incredible writers, great voices, and something to say. Very, very little places that they can get exposure.
It's very difficult to get
I had
heard
1,000 clubs in Britain. I mean, I started, I used to go to the Marquee to see people like the Moody Blues and Jeff Beck and everyone. I had a residency at the Marquee. By the time I started, every Thursday, I sang there. Mm-hmm. Rod Stewart was on first, then there was me. You can't do that now. We were 2 feet away, the audience, from...
Same for acting in many ways, because the repertory has kind of gone. You don't have a chance to really... Because of practice your whole routine from that point of view, really develop that whole system.
You need to, at some time in your career, if you get tremendous success at the beginning, you're going to have to go and do the work at some time. And that's why sometimes people achieve incredible stardom and they disappear and then you see them come back and they've remade themselves. If you just look at pop singers now today, they're crossing over virtually onto all the showmanship. Concert tours are not a pop singer standing there with a band behind them. I'm not crazy the way the business has taken off because I don't think it's artist-based anymore. I think it's corporate-based. I know that money has to be made, but I think a lot of talent is thrown aside because it doesn't fit into whatever...
A lot of it's manufactured as well, I believe. There's an awful lot of manufactured bands now.
Are you saying Simon Cowell manufactures people?
Yes.
How a band and to go in and you know, that... The most scary thing in your life when you make your first record is because you finally realise that you're the melody. You don't know that when you're singing along to songs. You go there, you just hear this orchestra or a band and you're the melody. And all you're worried about is that, you know, you don't sing a bum note. They don't think about that now because...
Auto-tune.
It's kind of like, oh, you can't really sing. You're not the best looking and you're not that talented. Should be number one.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
If you're on reality television, it opens up a whole new world.
That is the star of today. Is a reality show has nothing to do with. I mean, my very good friends are the Kardashians because Chris was my bridesmaid, and I've known Kim and Courtney since they were little babies, and I held Courtney, Chloe, when she was about 3 minutes old. So I've known. But this has nothing to...
Are you squeeing there?
Is that a squeak?
Patricia, are you squeeing?
Just a little, but only a little.
But that has nothing to do with talent and show business.
It hasn't got art in it anymore.
No,
it's all about being famous now and not actually talent.
Being famous was something that came along with being able to express your art form. And if you enjoyed it and were good at it, that's great. but that to be the basis of your life. Listen, if you can make 50 million out of doing that, good luck to you. I want everyone to succeed. But it has nothing to do with the part of the business that all of us have our heart in, which is that creative, and it's sad.
Get me started on that.
There are some, I must say, though, I don't want to, it sounds like, oh my goodness, you know, it was great in my day. We have some incredible, incredibly talented artists today. You know, I mean, I love Beyonce.
She's amazing.
Love Ed Sheeran. I mean, come on, mm-hmm. The world is better
Big
for
Gaga
them.
Big Gaga fan myself.
Yes, Lady Gaga, sing her, sit at a piano and play.
She can really sing.
Incredible. But it's that there are so many of those that you will never, ever see. Because of the way the business is now.
On a programme we've been talking about Peter Tork. Peter Tork, Michael Nesmith, Mickey DeLenz, Davy Jones, they'd actually done The Apprenticeship. They actually signed up for the audition, wanted four crazy boys. People talk about them being manufactured.
They were manufactured in the sense that they were just kids that they plucked and went, you've got a nice looking face, we'll take you. They were theatrically trained, and there were people who were writers. Mike Nesmith was a really, really good writer.
And his mum invented Tippex.
Yeah.
Really?
So there we are. Helps in all sorts of ways. Liquid paper.
And he never did it for the money.
No.
Because he never, ever, nor did Peter Tork. Most of the boys, Mickey Dolenz not so much, not Davy Jones, but those two boys came from very, very wealthy backgrounds. And there was I think my first wage was £20 a week. And I worked 7 days a week. I was in the Jimmy Cliff Show, and we worked 4 hours every night, and we drove maybe 10 hours a day.
Wow!
And
slept on the journey most of the time, no doubt.
It was immaterial.
And maybe it's worth noting, of course, Richard Lester directed the Beatles in Help, and I think the Monkees owe a lot to the movie Help.
Speaking of the whole way that it was shot, that was the Monkees. That's how the TV show came.
I have to ask: did you ever actually get to meet Paul McCartney?
Yes. Yes, I did. I was dating a guy at the time called Chaz Chandler, who was the bass player. He was an animal. And he was 6'7", and I was 5'3". And he took me to see Doris Troy. I never forget it. He took me to see Doris Troy at the Flamingo Club in London. She was fantastic. And I'm sitting there, and he said to me, oh, have you met Paul? And I'm just watching Doris Troy and thinking, she's really good. And I went, oh, hi, how are you? It's Paul. And I said, hi. And it took me about 10 seconds, and I thought, it's Paul McCartney. I thought I was going to scream and become hysterical. So I had to say, could you excuse me for a minute? I got up, went to the ladies, and ran around the ladies for about 5 minutes. It's Paul McCartney, it's Paul McCartney, it's Paul McCartney, it's Paul McCartney, it's Paul McCartney. Be cool, be cool. I came back and I just chatted for a bit. That was the first time I met him.
Honestly, for Pete's sake.
For Pete's sake.
Shine. Hi, this is Chase Masterson, founder of the Pop Culture Hero Coalition, the first ever organization to make a stand against bullying, racism, misogyny, LGBT bullying, cyberbullying, and other forms of hate using pop culture stories that we love. We all love superheroes. Why not be one? Check out our website at www.popcultureherocoalition.org. Follow us on Facebook at Pop Culture Hero Coalition and on Twitter at @superheroIRL. Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Stone Tapes with Sam Stone, David J. Howe, Patricia H. Ash, George Mann, and Robin Pierce. A show which sheds a little slice of geek sunshine into the ether.
Oh, so we're back with the Stone Tapes, and we're here with Aisha Broff. And Patricia, I wonder if you've got any questions for Aisha. Don't know if you recognise this music. Well, this is from Aisha's, the series she starred in, The UFO, which perhaps you'd like to tell us a little bit about how you became involved with UFO, Aisha.
Oh dear. I don't have stories like normal people, how I got the job. There was, I did a photo shoot in one of London's parks, and the photographer, I think it was for like the Daily Mail, happened to choose a statue that was only about 5'5" tall. So when you put me next to it, all the other statues were like 8 feet tall. It looked like I was as tall as the statue. And Sylvia and Gerry Anderson were about to do UFO. They had graduated from little people with strings to real live people.
Yes.
And they wanted Amazonian kinds of girls, and they wanted them with a certain look. They wanted them to be different looking. So they saw this photograph of me in the newspaper, and they called me in, and they said, and when I remember I hit the door, and as the door opened, she went, "Oh goodness, you're very short, aren't you?" And I went, "I'm not short, I'm just average." And so they said, "Oh, we thought you were like 6 foot tall, because we want really, really tall girls." So I said, "Well," but Sylvia loved me, and Sylvia said, "No, I want her, so you've got to do the screen test. And we do want you, but you're going to have to test, and we've got to try the costumes and that." So when I went to do the test, they gave me a silver dress, which I never actually wore. I wore if you look at any of the series, I wore like a cat suit all the time. But for the audition and for the screen test, they gave me the silver dress, which on Gabriella Drake and Dolores Mantes came about 6 inches up their thigh. It was a full-length evening dress on me to my ankle, and I'm like dragging around in this chainmail silver dress, and I thought, I'm never going to get this job. I look terrible. So I thought, at least if I can roll it up, and if I stuff my bra, that will take 3 or 4 inches up, and I have thick socks on. So I stuff my boobs with these thick woolly socks. I now had these enormous knockers. And little legs and the long frock. And I came out onto the set.
It's Lady Penelope.
And I must have looked like a cartoon. Anyway, I did my scene and whatever, and they said, "We're going to have some costumes made for you because the ones we have are not going to work." So that was it. And they booked me for like 2 days, and I ended up being there for like 18 months.
Patricia, are you familiar with UFO?
No, I'm not. I think it was before me.
Yeah, it's one of Gerry Anderson's, masterpieces, really. Brilliant series.
Came out in, like, 1975.
69, 70. Space 1999 was 73, 75. Wow. UFO was 1970, 69, 70. And actually, the second series of UFO, which was due to actually be commissioned, actually became Space 1999, because they said, "We'd like to actually set it all on the moon." So Space 1999 took over from that, and then obviously that changed when Fred Freiberger took over for the second.
I know I shot one in 69 because I married in 69, and they played a joke on me. I'd said I'm getting married, you know, like in 4 weeks' time. And they said, fine, fine, you can have the day off. And the day
good of them.
Yeah, yeah. And the day before I was shooting, they handed me my call sheet for the next day for 7 a.m. And I said to them, oh, I can't be here. And they said, oh, the whole scene's around. You've got to be here. I said, I'm getting married tomorrow. There's 200 people going to be there. I cannot come. And they said, I'm sorry. We cannot spend that kind of money on a day's filming. They had me. I was having a heart attack. And then they all burst out laughing. Gave me a cake.
A classic question. I never actually managed to put this to Gerry Anderson, but was the reason you actually had a wonderful necklace which had the letter A on, and just to actually remind people that you were A for Aisha?
I think it's because what happened was during the time that they had booked me and I'd only just started doing Liftoff, and it took off, and they suddenly had somebody that they had signed for X amount of money who was doing really well, and she said, you can wear the A. Everybody nice. Knows you.
Ah.
So my name was actually Lieutenant Johnson, but I don't know. Yeah, she said, yeah. And she was very good. She said, I don't want to make you look too different from the way that you look. They were wonderful people, I have to say. Sylvia and Gerry Anderson treated me like family.
You are actually on the opening credits. I mean, it's you that we see.
Yeah, that's because Gerry called me there. That's my backside. Now, he had me down.
Well, I wasn't going to say that, but yeah. Your backside features a lot.
It's every week. And and that's what people go, oh, it's your bum. You know, between the others.
So, well, if it's a choice between Michael Billington, George Sewell, and Aisha Braff in terms of real
George,
life, I know, yeah, yes. I know what I'm going
to
say.
George used to say, my face or her butt, come on, come on. But no, he said he kept shooting me during the day, and I was walking towards him. And then towards the end of the day, he said, you walk down there and we'll follow. And I'm thinking, if they follow, how can they see my face?
I think there was a method in their madness.
And I was folder acting. I had the folder in
very
the
impressive.
Arm, and I was acting and acting, and it was just my bum.
Clipboards. Many people on the BBC still use that technique today.
Just clipboard acting.
So, any questions for Aisha on UFO or any other?
I've got one about another show.
Mm-hmm.
Jason King.
Mm-hmm.
Was it as much fun as it looks to do?
Was it as much fun? It was good. It was good. There was a nice atmosphere. Peter Wingard was very much an actor, you know.
Oh, really?
Yes, he was an actor. He didn't play around a lot. And he had that was the height of that look, you know, with the long hair, the bell bottom and the whole thing. That was my first ever screen kiss. I have never been so petrified in my life. You know, and when you see that coming at you with all the hair.
The moustache.
And the moustache. And the collar and the tie. I remember thinking, you mustn't back away. You mustn't back away. You've got to go in for it.
Was it some time spent brushing teeth beforehand? I can imagine I would be doing
that. Oh, God, you've eaten a whole thing of Polo mints and you're just breathing into your hand or whatever. I don't think he cared, but, yeah. No, it was enjoyable. It was lovely for me because it was directed by a man called Jeremy Summers, who directed me in a couple of UFOs.
Okay.
And so he actually brought me into the show, and he was is a lovely man. Excuse me, I don't know, he's retired now. But and there was another one who was fabulous too, Dave Tomlinson. He did all The Prisoner.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, wow, yeah.
We had some fabulous directors. Fabulous directors.
And we shot it at Pinewood. Secret headquarters for Shadow. Pinewood.
And we had guest stars, every wonderful people. I can remember Patrick Moa came in and Adrian Curry, wonderful people.
Philip Maddock.
Yeah, yeah.
Shall we have some Lady Gaga and Shallow?
I think that's a really good idea. I'm just thinking.
Tell me something, girl. Are you happy in this modern world? Or do you need more? Is there something else you're searching for? I'll fall in all the good times I find myself longing for change, and in the bad times I fear myself.
Tell me something, boy. Aren't you tired trying to fill that void? Or do you need more? Ain't it hard keeping it so hardcore? I'm falling. In all the good times I find myself longing for change, and in the bad times I fear myself. I'm of the deep end, watch as I dive in. I'll never meet the ground. Crash through the surface where they can't hurt us. We're far from the shallow. In the shallow, in the shallow, in the shallow, we're far from the shallow now.
And I have to say that is my favourite film and favourite song at the moment. Shallow, Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. And it won the Oscar this week. So well done, Gaga and Mr. Cooper. Fantastic.
Or several weeks ago, depending on when you're listening to the podcast.
Well, that's right. Absolutely. Confusing. Well, yes, I'm just confused, everybody. So we're here in the studio on the Stone Tapes with the lovely Aisha Brough as our special guest this week. And Aisha, we'd just like to talk to you about Hollywood. Mm-hmm. How did you end up over there?
It was all the shocker wearing those outfits on the UFO. A very good friend of mine, Susan George, asked me to come out and stay with her for a few days. And I'd been on tour in Germany. And I said, well, I can only come for a little while. And the strange thing was, about 6 months before that, I'd gone out there thinking about, this is the place that I've got to go for my career. And And I did not enjoy myself at all. I loved Los Angeles. I loved the weather and that. But the truth was, I went through an identity crisis because nobody knew me. And it felt weird because in London as well, which is where I was based, and people knew me because I was on TV every week, and I felt like I could walk down the street and 100 strangers would say hello and nothing. I walked into a restaurant in LA and, you know, they like stepped over me. It was not great. So I thought, well, I don't particularly want to go. But I said, okay. So I came out and I was going to stay with her for a few days. And she threw a party to introduce me to her friends in America because we knew each other very well in England. We used to play charades every weekend and that whole group of people, Diana Dawes' son, and it was all these young theatricals, and that's what we used to do. So she threw the party and I met a man called Michael I. Levy that evening. And about 2 weeks later, he'd asked me, would I move to America and be with him? And because I'm mental, I came back gave up my television job and everything and my home and moved to California. And I married him 9 months later. And we were very, very happy for a long time. About 4 years, and during which time I made a couple of movies. I did Demolition Man and a couple of other things. But unfortunately, Michael didn't really want me to be in show business. He was been the president of a studio and was now a producer. It's not really what he wanted me to do. So we divorced, and I think that was a choice. Was I going to come back home and start again? Or I have to say the LA sunshine's very tempting, and my life was great. And so I stayed, and I started an interior design business, which did very well. And that's what I did until I came back to take care of my elderly parents.
Wow. And you made a lot of friends, you mentioned before, the Kardashians. How did you first meet Chris Kardashian?
I met Chris the second day that I was in America, because I'd met Michael the second day, and I met Chris the third day. He took me to dinner at her house when she was married to Robert, and she and I got on really, really well. There was then only Courtney and Kim. They were young. They were like 4 and 5. And then we stayed friends, and then Chloe was born, and then Robert was born. And I was very, very good friends with Robert. Long after they divorced, I decorated his house, and we stayed friends. And there was some that was a whole strange era. This is a bit spooky, but I had a guest house with my house, and unfortunately, the young girl that used to stay there was murdered. She, I was meant to meet her for tea. It was about 2 very dodgy years, and was meant to meet her for tea. And I always said that my spending saved my life. On the way to meet her, I saw this incredible garden furniture, and I had to meet her at 4 o'clock, and it was about 3:45, and I thought, I'll just run in and get this furniture. So I ran in and I got the furniture, and by the time I got to my house, she'd left, because she hadn't waited. It was too late for us to have tea, and she'd gone home and she'd got murdered.
Oh, good grief. Good grief.
Then a little bit later, we're cutting to, of course, the Kardashians. The last time that Chris and I did anything that was a big public thing was OJ's funeral. Was
And we'll have to have you back to talk about that, because we're out of time. Thank you so much to Aisha Broth. Thank you. To George Mann.
Thank you.
Patricia H. Ash.
Thank you.
Alex Lefchuk.
Thank you.
And my name's Sam Stone, and you've been listening to the Stone Tapes. Until next time. Again.